Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 27th of June, these are our main stories. G7 leaders say they will support Ukraine for as long as it takes in its fight against Russia's invasion. Residents of the eastern Ukrainian city of Lysychansk have been urged to leave because of heavy Russian bombardment. And NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has announced a huge increase in troop numbers for the alliance's high readiness force. Also in this podcast, 5 days after an earthquake struck Afghanistan, some villages still haven't received any aid.
We have had at least 2 aftershocks each day. People are too scared to go into their homes. There is sadness and hunger everywhere.
When Russian forces rolled into Ukraine on February the 24th this year, many observers thought the capital would fall within days. But the war has ground on, with Ukraine fighting hard for every scrap of territory and its friends offering support in the form of military hardware and sanctions against Russia. On Monday, after President Zelensky again asked them for more heavy weapons, G7 leaders meeting in the German Alps promised to stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said the leaders had discussed the importance of remaining united in their approach.
We understood that the policies of all our countries are very much aligned. And this is, I think, the good message, that we are taking tough decisions, that we are also cautious, that we will help the Ukraine as much as is possible, but that we also avoid that there will be a big conflict between Russia and NATO. And this is what is of essence, to be tough and thinking about the necessities of the time we are living in.
So given that note of caution about a wider conflict, just how united are the G7 leaders? A question for our correspondent, Jenny Hill, who's at the summit.
They've released a really strongly worded statement, actually, on Ukraine, in which they have said they will continue to support President Zelensky and his country's efforts to repel the Russian invasion. And they will continue to support it militarily. They haven't given us details of that yet, but they say they will be coordinating efforts when it comes to the supply of equipment, weapons, and the training of troops, and so on. So it's not now just about financial aid. It's not now just about political support. They're saying that, you know, they are really going to continue. They're in there for the long haul until Ukraine is able to regain its territorial sovereignty. They've also issued a pretty strong demand to Vladimir Putin while they're at it, telling him that he must immediately and unconditionally withdraw from Ukrainian territory defined by internationally recognised borders. Now, that, of course, includes Crimea, which Vladimir Putin annexed in 2014. So pretty strident words. In terms of actual reality, we don't know what kind of weapons would be delivered and so on. That, of course, will be thrashed out, I guess, either later or, you know, in the days and weeks to come. And, of course, you mentioned NATO. The NATO summit starts again, begins a little later this week.
And all the leaders, of course, will be very focused on the repercussions around the world of this conflict, not least in terms of fuel and grain.
Yeah, and that's why this statement from the leaders, I think, is so interesting. Actually, interesting for two reasons. First of all, a lot of these leaders are under considerable political pressure themselves. They've got, you know, problems at home, think Boris Johnson, Emmanuel Macron, even President Biden. And they've got electorates who are really feeling the pinch from this increasing cost of living, becoming a crisis in many places. That's exacerbated by the ongoing conflict. There were suggestions that, you know, as a result of that, some of those leaders might not be so committed to continuing their support for Ukraine. Well, this document rather puts paid to that suggestion. The other reason I think this document is interesting is that there have been, of course, analysts, politicians, a lot of people who've suggested that at some point Ukraine will simply have to hand over some of the territory that's been gained by Vladimir Putin in order to secure an end to hostilities. You know, very controversial idea, fiercely resisted, of course, by Ukraine. But this document makes very clear that it's for Ukraine to decide its own future. Ukraine has the right to its own territorial integrity, and that the leaders have committed to the idea that there will be no external pressure on Ukraine to the terms of any future, potential future peace settlement. So I think what we can really take from this statement is that the leaders here are genuinely united in their resolve to continue helping Ukraine resist the Russian invasion, and that they don't really see that there's any other way forward.
That was Jenny Hill in Germany. NATO has announced what it calls the biggest overhaul of its collective defence and deterrence since the Cold War. The Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg described Russia as the most significant and direct threat to the alliance's security and values.
We will strengthen our forward defences. We will enhance our battle groups in the eastern part of the alliance up to brigade levels. We will transform the NATO response force and increase the number of our high readiness forces to well over 300,000. We will also boost our ability to reinforce in crisis and conflict.
The new strategic concept, due to be approved in this week's summit in Madrid, will also for the first time address the challenges China poses for the alliance. The Ukrainian authorities have urged residents of the eastern city of Lysychansk to leave immediately. Joe Inwood reports from Kyiv.
Getting out of Lysychansk is easier said than done. But that is what the governor of Luhansk province is advising anyone who remains there to do, despite the dangers. Sergei Hidai said the situation there was very difficult and that there remains a real threat to life and health. The only route out to Ukrainian territory is a single road that is said to be under constant Russian shelling. The city now appears to be the new focus of Russia's offensive, surrounded on at least two sides. If it falls, Moscow will control all of Luhansk province.
That was Joe Inwood. Well, one of the biggest issues on the agenda at that G7 meeting in Germany is how to get grain out of Ukraine, one of the world's biggest wheat producers. The UN is warning of famine in Africa and the Middle East, in part because of the disruption to supplies. Now, a BBC investigation has found evidence that Russian forces have stolen thousands of tons of grain from areas of Ukraine that they now occupy. Our correspondent Nick Beek in Kyiv has been looking at the findings.
For months we've had those allegations of the Russian theft of Ukrainian grain. It's been quite difficult at times to pin it down, really, to provide evidence. But our team here managed to contact more than 200 farmers living in occupied territory. Most of them were too worried for their safety to talk to us in detail. But one landowner, who we're calling Dmitro, agreed to meet us. And he described how Russian soldiers arrived at his farm and then the grain stores were completely cleared out. And we obtained CCTV images showing troops at the farm. One of them was seen trying to shoot out the security camera, but failing. And the grain stores were then, in the following days, completely cleared out. Now, Dmitro's words are voiced here by an actor.
They destroyed our premises, destroyed our equipment. Everything they saw, everything they touch disappears.
They looted our offices, even pulled the wiring from the walls and took away the photographs of our relatives.
And Nick, you and the team have been able to trace some of the vehicles stolen from this farmer's land and indeed the journey they've taken.
Yeah, that's right, Rob. We followed the GPS trackers in a number of Dmitro's vehicles, and we focused in particular on two grain trucks, and we traced them from the farm to Crimea, which of course Russia annexed in 2014, and then on to mainland Russia. And on the way, we found out that the truck stopped at this one particular silo. And from satellite images we obtained, we could see there is now a large Z symbol, of course, the symbol of the Russian invasion, right on the top of this storage facility. Now, that may be a message to the Russian fighter jets overhead, or possibly to the wider world. But here's Dmitro on the impact this is having both on him and on other Ukrainian farmers.
The Russians are destroying us as a nation, as people who strive for freedom and work. They don't want us to have this land, to earn from this land. I think there are so many people in the world now sitting eating a sandwich, not realizing that this grain has been stolen and that so many people are suffering. I don't understand why the world is silent and not doing anything to punish this injustice.
You can see the photo, satellite, CCTV and GPS data all laid out in Nick's long read on the BBC website. Nick, what is Russia saying in response to all of this?
We've seen documents that have been issued by Russian installed authorities in Ukraine, and they are telling local farmers that their grain is to be seized. The justification for this is what the Russian occupying authorities are saying is securing the food security of the area. There doesn't seem to be much of a negotiation about this. And if you talk privately to Ukrainian officials, they believe as much as 800,000 tonnes of grain have been stolen since the start of the invasion. Normally at this time of year, they'd be harvesting the field, but so many of the fields are mined, workers have fled, those who remain are still living in fear, and this, of course, is something the G7 leaders will be talking about, not just the disruption on Ukraine, but on food supplies to some of the poorest countries in the world.
Nick Beek was speaking to Rob Young. A BBC Africa Eye investigation has exposed a human trafficking network smuggling disabled children from Tanzania to Kenya. Many are taken from their parents with the promise of a better life. But instead, the children are forced to beg on the streets, often for years, while their captors take all of the profits. Africa Eye helped one victim escape. Jerry Mwangi reports from Nairobi.
On the streets of Nairobi, there are hundreds of disabled beggars. Many tell me they were brought here from Tanzania as children, and I soon realize they're being watched. As I'm speaking to one boy, he gets a phone call.
Hello.
And then quickly leaves without saying another word. I meet another boy in a crowded market. He starts speaking to me. But as soon as he makes eye contact with his minder, he's put onto a trolley and taken away.
Oh my gosh.
For more than a year, I've been investigating the cruel trade in disabled beggars. Their stories are heartbreaking. I met one young man, now in his 20s, who's been enslaved by traffickers for almost half his life. His name is Farah, and he told me the traffickers cut off all contact with his family. Farah was making the equivalent of $6,000 a year from begging, but his captors took it all. One morning, we staked out the area where Farah and others like him were being held in overcrowded properties.
Oh my goodness, this is another one.
In just 15 minutes, we saw dozens of children being sent off to beg. Irene Wagema runs a rescue center for disabled children and thinks the problem is getting worse.
Since last year, the numbers have increased, and especially in Nairobi. They are so vulnerable, you're exposing them to every danger out there. And the way they are kept, it's inhumane.
I wanted to know what the families in Tanzania had been told. I flew there and met journalist Florence Majani. She told me traffickers target the poorest families, promising their children a better life.
Most of them are living in a poor conditions. And then comes this chance of some other people who are taking them from Tanzania to Nairobi. They think our children are supported, they will come back one day with some money.
But the reality is very different. Florence introduced me to a family who gave their disabled child up to traffickers when she was 9 years old. That was 5 years ago, and she hasn't been seen since. It's taken a terrible toll on the family. Back in Nairobi, Farah eventually told us that he's regularly beaten by his captors if he doesn't make enough money. We immediately alerted the Nairobi police, and officers launched a series of raids. In one property, they found a young child and five people being held in a windowless room. Two men were arrested and charged with human trafficking. They deny the allegations. Farah was finally freed. He's now receiving support in a care home until he can be reunited with his family.
Jerry Mwangi. Still to come.
It's a very traditional cuisine. It's very much influenced by the Fulani people. I wanted to cook food that I grew up eating.
A chef from Sierra Leone becomes the first African winner of one of the world's most prestigious gastronomy prizes. Russia had until Sunday to pay $100 million in interest on some of its international debts. But the deadline appears to have passed without creditors receiving the money, putting Russia in default for the first time since 1998. So what's the Kremlin's response? A question for Sergei Goryashko from the BBC Russian service.
Well, Moscow denies that any default actually happened because President spokesperson Dmitry Peskov just told journalists that payment was due and Russia paid, and Russia sent the money to the Euroclear Bank. But the problem that the bank did not distribute the payments to investors is not Russia's problem, which is why Russia denies that there was any default. And the same thing was said by the finance ministry, Anton Siluanov, who also claims that the situation is just a farce. If we compare the situation to the 1998, this default is mostly a symbolic event, in fact, because it just shows that Russia is not longer possible to conduct normal financial business in the world. But it doesn't mean a lot for Russian citizens, in fact.
OK, so symbolic or not, though, it will be recorded as a default. What might the longer-term impact be on Russia?
It's hard to tell what the longer-term of exactly this event will be, because in this fact, it just shows political toxicity and the problems with the Russian economy, which is cut out from the Western world. But, for instance, it could actually be helpful for those investors who are still have friendly relations with Russia to come up on the market and to buy obligations cheaper. But in fact, if we talk about the situation in the economy, Russia's economy for now, there are more things which are more scary than the default itself, like this toxicity I've already mentioned and the longer term consequences of the ongoing war in Ukraine, which Russia's economy will have to meet pretty much soon. And these things will be felt by the Russian citizens.
That was Sergei Goryashko from the BBC Russian service. The earthquake in Afghanistan, which killed more than 1,000 people last week, struck in some of the country's most remote areas. The BBC has found that deep in the mountains of the worst-affected Paktika province, there are villages where there's been a lot of destruction, but no aid has reached them so far. Our South Asia correspondent Yogita Lemoye took a very bumpy drive there to the village of Dwegur and sent this report.
I'm in the district worst affected by the earthquake. To get here, it's taken us hours on a very winding and mountainous road from the nearest town. And up to a point, we've passed trucks that are carrying relief material. We've been told by locals at the point where eight trucks are parked that there are many villages beyond that point which have also been affected by the earthquake, where people have died, where homes have been destroyed, and so far no aid or relief has reached there. And we're driving now to get to one of them. I've arrived in the village of Dwegur. In front of me I can see mud homes that are scattered on the mountainside. And I can also see that in the flat areas there are two large makeshift tents, so they're basically pieces of plastic and cloth that have been strung between bamboo sticks that are stuck into the ground. And I'm just walking uphill now. To the left of me, there's a wall that's been completely destroyed. And as I walk further, literally every structure here has deep cracks. And I've now been taken to some of the homes, entering one of them now. It's been pretty much reduced to debris. Arafat Giankel is 20. He was buried under the rubble of his house, and four of his family members died. One of them was his mother.
Something hit my head hard, and I thought I would die. But I managed to crawl out from under the rubble. I moved stones and mud aside and found my mother. When I touched her, I realized she had died. I loved her so much. I miss her immensely. That night, she had exchanged the positions we normally slept in. I survived, and she died.
His brother's wife and their two children were also killed, as was a 12-year-old boy from another family. Dozens of people from the village have been injured. I've come now to the house of a village elder here, Taj Ali Khan. His home has also been almost completely destroyed.
We have had at least two aftershocks each day. People are too scared to go into their homes. There is sadness and hunger everywhere. No one has come to our aid. We need food and money to rebuild our homes.
I'm looking at the mountains further east of this village, and a local has just pointed out in a few different directions and told me there are more such small villages and hamlets located all over the mountainside. They too have faced destruction because of the earthquake. People have died in some of them. And locals here tell me that no relief or aid has reached those villages either. It is quite clear that Afghanistan is in need of a lot of support. It also needs the means to reach these remote, far-flung areas. So whether it's more air power or experienced disaster response teams, the Taliban government doesn't have that. Countries around the world are not sending their people in because they do not recognize the group that runs this nation. Caught in the middle of it are thousands of people who've been left on their own.
Yogatala Maye. The head of the African Union has expressed his deep shock and concern at what he called the degrading treatment of African migrants after 23 died trying to cross from Morocco into the Spanish enclave of Melilla. Moussa Faki Mohamed called for an immediate investigation into Friday's incident when hundreds stormed the border fence. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
More than 1,500 sub-Saharan migrants came down from the nearby mountains to attempt to climb the 6-metre-high fences surrounding Melilla. They were met by Moroccan border guards, and in the ensuing clashes, Morocco says 23 migrants died, many of them apparently squashed between the police and the fences. Human rights organisations say the death toll was higher, and they said the migrants are being buried in unmarked graves without their bodies being identified. NGOs in Spain and Morocco have called for an investigation into the police's behaviour amid accusations of brutality.
Guy Hedgeco. At least four people were killed and dozens injured when a crowded wooden grandstand at a bullfighting festival in Colombia collapsed on Sunday. Video footage captured the moment that part of the arena made of what looked like wooden poles fell. The three-storey structure came down in the western city of Espinal during a traditional event where members of the public are encouraged to enter the ring to confront the bulls. Reddy Tlabi spoke to Cristina Munoz, a journalist in Bogota.
Local authorities declared a sanitary red alert considering that hundreds of injured were attended in El Espinal where the accident took place. Others were transferred in ambulances to nearby cities. At least four people died, including a 3-year-old toddler. The incoming president, Gustavo Petro, who has expressed its rejection against bullfighting, asked majors not to authorize more of these type of events, and Iván Duque that he will call for an investigation to determine what caused this tragedy.
It's not the first time that such an accident had happened. I mean, when you look at the reaction this time around, is it likely that President-elect's suggestion not to allow mayors to carry through with these events involving the death of peoples or animals, is it likely that that would happen?
It is not on the hands of the president, but the Congress. The outgoing Congress debated to ban once and for all bullfighting. It didn't make any resolutions. In Bogota, bullfighting was banned in 2012. Since the 90s, the popularity of bullfighting has dropped down notoriously across the region.
And the general public, does it support a ban or do they see bullfighting as integral to their culture?
Colombia's public opinion is divided on this issue. If banned, the most affected will definitely be the professional bullfighters, the breeders, and other businessmen who would lose their main incomes, all of them linked to the country's upper classes. Bullfighting sympathizers requested UNESCO to include bullfighting into its heritage list, but it failed in 2020.
Is there likely to be legal action? Because we understand in this particular incident, a wooden grandstand that was crowded with the spectators actually collapsed. So can there be some liability, some legal recourse that is expected?
Yes, that is expected, definitely. All public events, especially these ones with thousands of attendees, need authorizations. And if they do not comply with the safety measures, they have to face the law.
That was Christina Munoz in Bogota. Schools in the Chinese capital Beijing have fully reopened nearly 2 months after closing because of COVID. The authorities have eased some COVID restrictions as infection rates are falling. We heard more from our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
It's obviously a major step. Beijing is a city with millions and millions of people, hundreds of thousands of school children. They'll have been at home working on their computers, but obviously that's not as good as being back in the classroom. Some students have been back for several weeks, those who had exams to take, but this is all of the school pupils back to school. Next week it's going to be kindergartens. Also importantly, kids are going to be allowed to do sport outside in the open together for the first time. So really another indication that Beijing is getting back to normal.
OK, so that's all in the capital. What's going on in Shanghai? Because they've obviously had very strict lockdowns there.
They had 2 months of lockdown, which the city began to reopen at the beginning of this month. But that's been a slow process. Not all areas have reopened. Not all sectors have reopened. What's happening on Wednesday is that restaurants are going to be accepting diners inside for the first time for many, many weeks. So that's another step. So again, in Shanghai, we see the trend towards reopening. Both those cities there have managed to keep new COVID infections down to just a handful of cases. That's why the authorities feel more relaxed. In fact, the Shanghai Communist Party chief said, "We've won the war over COVID," just a couple of days ago, though. So the trend is positive there.
OK, so the trends are towards reopening, but it looks like the policy of zero COVID might go on for some time.
Yes, and we've got to remember that in other parts of China, of course, they still have restrictions. Shenzhen, over the weekend, this is a city right on the border with Hong Kong, reimposed some restrictions for public places. And there, you mentioned, again, zero COVID. The reason these restrictions are being lifted is not because the policies change, it's because they've got a handle on the new infections. In fact, just today, the authorities in Beijing issued a statement in which they suggested that this zero COVID policy could last 5 years, a total 5 years, an extraordinary length of time, which had lots of people, you know, really sitting up and taking notice. That statement was retracted, but I think you just got a window into the mind of policymakers there. They're loosening restrictions because infections are going down, not because they've changed their mind about the overall policy.
That was Michael Bristow. Now, let's hear from the chef, Fatmata Binta, who has just won the Basque Culinary World Prize 2022, known as the Nobel Prize for Gastronomy. She is the first African to receive it, and she won it for her campaign for sustainable eating and upholding traditions of Fulani nomads. She spoke to us from Accra in Ghana. Reddy Tlabi began by asking her about her cooking.
It's a very traditional cuisine. It's very much influenced by the Fulani people. I'm a Fulani from Guinea-Conakry. That's where my family is from, but I was born and raised in Sierra Leone. But culturally, I'm so much more a Guinean because I used to spend a lot of time during vacations in Guinea. So that shaped me a lot as a chef. So once I went to culinary school and worked in the hotels, I saw how food what's been done, you know, the stories we are told. I wanted to talk about and cook food that I grew up eating. And the food I grew up eating is very much sustainable because it's very much centered around the lifestyle of the Fulani people. These are people who are always on the go. These are people who are minimalist. These are people who don't carry much. So I was very much fascinated by that and I wanted to tell that story. So I started a nomadic pop-up restaurant called Dine on a Mat under the company name Fulani Kitchen. And our main goal is to create vibrant dishes inspired by Fulani communities across Africa, hosting pop-up dinners, telling stories, but most importantly, preserving the traditional way of cooking.
And speaking of the traditional way and the nomad dining experience, you've been to three continents already. How challenging is your business model?
It is challenging because it's a very unique template that I didn't intentionally was creating a template. I was just going with my passion and heart and you know, love for the people. So the most challenging part is logistics, because you're hopping from one country to another. Even though I take the ingredients are not the hard part, because it's easy. This is a sustainable food. We preserve our food through sun drying. So the ingredients are easy to keep. But when it comes to like the mats, you know, the setup, it's always challenging. Sometimes you have to fuse the experience a bit for someone to get it.
What will you do with the prize money?
It's very much exciting right now. We are going to build a center in the north of Ghana, where we already have 4 acres of land, a place called Daboya. So I want to build a space where women can come in, learn arts and crafts that is very much authentic to the Fulani people, but also grow fonio and also buy fonio from women who are already doing it in the north of Ghana, and have that space where we can process it, package, and then distribute locally and internationally.
Fatmata Binta, Basque Culinary World Prize winner 2022. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Just before we go, if you are wondering what's happened to our listener relay, it seems that Mo Hashimoto from Tokyo has flummoxed you. She told us about her favourite place, Las Palmas de Gran Canaria. We're still waiting for someone there to pick up the baton. We know we have listeners in the Canary Islands, so if you are one of them, please do get in touch and tell us about your favourite place. To do that, or to comment on this podcast, or indeed to send poetry to Jonathan Savage, just use the email address globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Basil Oxterby. The producer was Ed Horton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.